This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Sonia Purnell, author of the new biography, Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's Astonishing Life of Power, Seduction, and Intrigue. Kingmaker delves into Pamela Harriman's transformation from a young aristocrat with little formal education into a power broker who dined with Eisenhower, saved JFK's life, and influenced major 20th century political events. Purnell uncovers her secret operations during World War II, where she used her charm and wit to secure American support for Britain, and later her pivotal role in Democratic Party's resurgence, helping to shape its direction through personal connections and strategic foresight. Sonia Purnell is a biographer and journalist, and her book, A Woman of No Importance, was a New York Times bestseller, winner of the Plutarch Award for Best Biography. And Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill, was chosen as a Book of the Year by The Telegraph and The Independent. Sonia Purnell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So how did you come to select Pamela Harriman as the next subject of biography?
What do you mean, apart from a great story of sex, money, and power?
Right.
Quite hard to tell. I mean, I bumped into her, stumbled across her, if you like, when I was writing my book about Clementine Churchill, who was Churchill's very overlooked and forgotten, misunderstood wife. And I realised back then, you know, who was this very young woman who both Winston and Clementine depended on so much during the war? What was it about her? What was she doing that earned their undying gratitude and thanks? In fact, they paid out of their own personal resources. They paid her a pension for it for the rest of their lives. So, you know, she intrigued me then. I knew she was someone special, and I knew that her papers would finally be opened up at the Library of Congress, which they were just before COVID struck us. And I had to wait for a sort of window in the lockdowns to go and have a look at these papers. And they were extraordinary, by the way. And also, so many people now finally prepared to talk about her, including Bill Clinton, but many others in American politics as well.
She's a couple of previous biographies were less than flattering, right? She's had a reputation less than flattering you. I guess one of your things you want to do is correct that.
Well, what struck me really was that the reality was often not the reputation that she had. And I think there were certain presumptions about her when she was still alive. That was a different time. People had different attitudes towards women. But most of all, I think, people simply didn't know what she'd got up to behind closed doors. And it's only now that she's been dead 27 years that we can finally see just what she achieved, both in Britain during the war in the 1940s and later on when she came to America, the 70s, 80s and 90s in American politics. She took American citizenship and became a real mover and shaker in the Democratic Party.
What was in her papers when you finally were able to get to them?
Well, what wasn't in her papers? So lots of letters with people like Joe Biden, for example, in 1988, when he previously ran for the presidency and had to withdraw after there were allegations of plagiarism, and everyone kind of dropped him at that point, apart from Pamela. And she wrote these letters to him, which are really quite moving, saying that she admires his courage and his dignity during this whole saga, that she will help him retire his campaign debt, and that not to worry because it was only a wrinkle in his career and he would eventually make it. Well, as we know, it took quite a long time, but he did get there in the end. So there were vignettes like that, vignettes also, minutes of phone calls and meetings with Nelson Mandela, who asked for her help for the first multiracial elections in South Africa. This had never been known before. And the first thing that alerted me was that I'd seen that he'd given her a painting of an ostrich, which was her family crest. And then I discovered why. And that's because of these meetings, these phone calls where he'd asked her for help with those first multinational racial elections in South Africa. He thought he was going to lose. He didn't know how to raise money set up an infrastructure, choose candidates, and he asked her help. So again, that was all in her papers, never previously known. And there was so much like that, quite extraordinary.
Tell me about the young Pamela, is it Digby?
Yes.
And her family.
Well, the young Pamela Digby was the eldest child of four children to Lord and Lady Digby, who lived in a remote part of southwestern England, led a very, very quiet life, which is how they like it. But the young Pamela wanted anything but. I mean, they were treated really down there after the last pandemic in the way that many people have moved to the country after the one that we've put up with in the last few years. But Pamela wanted the reverse. She wanted bright lights. She wanted to get into politics. That was so interesting to her. It was a subject that was pretty much taboo at home. Her parents didn't want her to discuss it. But, you know, they didn't either believe in educating her too much. It was then thought that if she knew too much, then she wouldn't make an alluring wife. And she was a debutante in the London season of 1938, where she was too inquisitive about world events. You know, this was just before the Second World War, of course. And that was thought to be odd and strange. And she was also a little plump, and you were supposed to have a waist of 17 inches in those days. And Pamela didn't quite achieve it at that point. And so I'm afraid her season was a disaster. But just before that season, she'd been sent, incredibly looking back on it, to Munich to be finished. Her parents thought that that would give her a sort of disciplined and polished kind of veneer, as it were. But of course, that was the city where the Nazis had their headquarters. And so she went from that very, very cosseted life straight into witnessing some of the, you know, human race's most appalling barbarism, cruelty. She saw people goose-stepping in the street. She heard Hitler's rabid speeches on the radio, and she was shocked and disturbed. And really, I think that set her up for the rest of her life. She wanted to combat tyranny, but she also saw how power could also do good. And so she really became what you might call today a political junkie. But of course, women were not supposed to be interested in politics. And then she had to find a way into politics that was her very own.
So she did find an entree into, you know, higher society and politics. She married Randolph Churchill. He was known as a philanderer, right? And a potentially bad husband. He'd asked several women to marry him previous to Pamela. I guess, why did Pamela say yes?
Yes, eight women turned him down that week before he asked Pamela. He was determined to, as he put it, you know, have a son before he went to war. And he took her out to dinner. He ignored her all the evening until coffee. And then he turned around and said, "You look healthy enough to bear my son. Will you marry me?" And amazingly, and considering the unromantic nature of his proposal, she said yes. Now, why did she say yes? Because, well, her parents disapproved hugely of Churchill. They thought him a bit of a sort of a political chancer and didn't, as I've said, you know, really agree with politicians at all. But she wanted that entree into high society and power and so on. So she thought, well, yes, I mean, I don't love Randolph. I've heard a few things about him, but he would be my entrance into that world, the world I crave so much and the world that my parents are never going to be able to give me. So amazingly, she said yes. She had a few wobbles, but they did get married 3 weeks later. I mean, quite extraordinary. There were smiles on the day, but they didn't last very long because, yes, indeed, Randolph turned out to be a drunk and a bully and perhaps a lot worse than that. But she quickly provided him with the required son and heir to the sort of the Churchill lineage. And then, interestingly, as Churchill sort of grew more and more distant from his son, who he found obnoxious and unreliable and drunk, but became closer and closer to Pamela. She provided him with support, undying support, but also a sounding board. She laughed at his jokes, she lit his cigar, but she was also so inquisitive and so good at absorbing facts and understanding what was happening in the World War. Now, you know, Britain had declared war on Germany. Britain was at war. It was fighting for its survival. Very, very tense times indeed, almost unimaginable now. The Blitz had started. If you imagine some of the bombing that's going on now and think that's what London was going through back then, but she provided him with something he really needed, which was an emotional sustenance, but also one where he could share the burdens of war, which were immense. But most of all, she understood completely from him that the only way Britain was going to survive, there was only one chance that it could continue the fight for any length of time, and that was enlisting American support. This is before Pearl Harbor, of course, and she became his secret weapon.
Yeah, tell me about that. This is quite extraordinary, right? And I guess we didn't know all of this until you got access to her papers.
Well, exactly, access to her papers and other people's comments and testimony and letters and so on. So putting together the entire story, it is incredible. So as we know, Britain somehow needed to change hearts and minds in America. America was going through quite an isolationist period. It didn't want to quite understandably get involved in another European war and spend more dollars, more American blood. At the time, a lot of people simply didn't accept that America itself was in danger. So those hearts and minds needed to be changed. And first of all, that was done by taking some very fetching pictures of her with her baby. These were sold deliberately to Life magazine as a sort of propaganda exercise, and a very endearing photograph was put on the front page of Life. Well, that really helped a lot. I can tell you she looks winsome, slightly vulnerable, very pretty in that photograph, but that was not going to be enough. The next thing really was winning over people that President Roosevelt sent over to London to see what was happening. The first one was Harry Hopkins, who she described as a dear but not a pin-up. And so she had certain techniques with him. She simply charmed him. And he noticed when he arrived that she was the apple of Churchill's eye. And within a few days, everyone else noticed that she'd become the apple of Harry Hopkins's eye as well. And he realized how, you know, plugged in she was. And in fact, he described her back in Washington as the most plugged in person in Britain after Churchill himself. And that was the briefing that the next envoy from Roosevelt had been given before he arrived. And that was Avril Harriman, who was considered a rather sort of aloof and a bit cold and maybe not susceptible to all these Churchillian charms that had so won over Harry Hopkins to the British cause. But actually, the Churchills, including Pamela, had done their homework, and they knew that he'd had a rather sort of disciplinarian childhood. He had certain insecurities. He noticed that no one ever laughed at his attempted jokes. And so a dinner party was arranged. She was bought the most elaborate gold lamé skin-typed dress. She was put next to him in the seating plan. It was all choreographed to the last minute, and then she started what became known as her mating dance, and that was she started with stroking his forearm, looking into his eyes with her. She had mesmerizing sapphire eyes herself. She looked absolutely sensational that night. She had the allure of power. She was known to be extremely close to Churchill, but she started sort of pumping him for information about Roosevelt and military thinking in America. He found this incredibly flattering. And then the next thing that happened, there was a huge raid, a terrible, terrible air raid on London. They pulled back the blackout curtains, obviously having turned the lights off. They saw the enemy planes come towards them. They saw Selfridge's department store catch fire. And Avril said to her, let's go down to my suite on a lower floor where it was safer so we can talk easier. Well, I can tell you that by the morning, they hadn't just been talking. I mean, this was a strategic seduction, if you like. And Avril Harriman had been won over to the British cause. He later said that there's nothing like the Blitz to get things going. And Pamela later said that was a very fortuitous raid. Now he too was entirely signed up to trying to help the Brits. But he was also in charge of the military aid program called Lend-Lease. So his opinion obviously was extremely important, vital even, because it would be up to him to see what equipment, or including actually food and medicine, should be sent to Britain. So his opinion was absolutely vital. But she didn't stop there. There were many other important, influential, key Americans that she went on to seduce, including Major General Frederick Anderson, who was in charge of bombing in the US Air Force and therefore very, very important person. Ed Murrow, the CBS war correspondent, extremely important. His boss, Bill Paley at CBS, and Jock Whitney, who was then in intelligence, many others too. So She had what people now call, professors now call, strategic sex life that was politically significant. And some people think, really, because a special relationship didn't exist then, that she, in effect, helped to create it through these emotional, physical ties. But always there was an ulterior motive, which was sort of sifting information to and fro. So putting the British case for more help, but also feeding information backwards, back to Churchill as to what she'd gleaned from the Americans, what was going on in Washington. This wasn't a hostile act. This was all about really kind of creating, sustaining and elevating the Anglo-American alliance, because that was the only way that the war was going to be won and Hitler defeated.
How important was she to securing America to the cause?
Well, I mean, obviously, Pearl Harbor brought America into the war. And until that point, though, it wasn't prepared to fight. It was prepared to give some kind of aid. At that point, what she did and the messages that she got across to America and back to Roosevelt ultimately were crucial, so that A, Britain could be saved. B, Britain was worth saving. Its people were plucky and courageous and fighting the very hardest. So that was important. But then it came down to detail that they needed access to American ports to repair warships because British ports were either damaged or overrun. All of these things were key. They needed American patrols in the North Atlantic. These sorts of things were fed back to the Americans through this channel. I mean, there were no other back channels really at the time, and they were very effective. After Pearl Harbor, it was often more a case of resolving disputes between the Allies, and including one that is notable on bombing strategies in the lead up to D-Day. The Americans wanted to bomb by day. That would mean fewer civilian casualties on the ground, hopefully, but was very dangerous for aircrew. The Brits rather preferred nighttime bombing because that was you lost fewer planes that way, but there was obviously this danger that you would kill many civilians. This was a terrible emotional and fraught dispute between the two allies, and what she would do would be to put the Churchill case to Major General Anderson, who would cogitate, talk to her about it, and she would feed back that to Churchill late at night, often over card games of Bezique and in Downing Street. And ultimately, a compromise was found between the two powers. It was not unhelpful that she was also sleeping with the head of the Royal Air Force. So this too gave her an authority, really, to talk about these things and try and help find resolutions and a way forward. And while she was doing this, by the way, and this was witnessed by Bill Walton, who was one of her closest friends and then a correspondent on Time and Life, she was in her early 20s. She started doing it when she was 21, and the war ended when she was 25. So she was handling this sort of information, you know, where most of us are way, 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 you know, far off from being able to handle something of that sort, because these were men under enormous stress. They had big egos often. They were handling a world war. And she managed to do that without a scandal coming out, without them worrying about her or distrusting her, without them becoming jealous of each other, apart from Ed Murray got a bit jealous at one point. But it's extraordinary how she could do that with such aplomb at such an early age. I find it really quite remarkable.
Let's take a brief break. We'll be back with more. We're talking with Sonia Purnell, author of Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's Astonishing Life of Power, Seduction, and Intrigue. More following this.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking with biographer Sonia Purnell, author of the new book, Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's Astonishing Life of Power, Seduction, and Intrigue. Sonia Purnell is author previously of A Woman of No Importance and Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. So, exciting time, the war. Pamela Harriman was had access to the center of power, Winston Churchill, doing, important work. Then the war ends, and I think she was lost for a time in peacetime.
Yes, I think she was. I mean, in the process of her work, she had certainly fallen for America and Americans. And at one point, I think she thought it really quite likely that she would marry Ed Morrow, though he was married to Janet at the time. Then Janet got pregnant and had a child. That was off. So she couldn't come to America. But at the end of, the war, she, like many women, saw her life contract. Only in her case, it was more epic than most. But this happened to many women who'd done great things during the war. And she wasn't sure what she was going to do. Churchill was now out of power. He had lost the 1945 election, so she no longer had access to Downing Street through him. She really didn't have very much money. She had no qualifications. She was now divorced, unsurprisingly, from Randolph, who, by the way, never, ever forgave his parents for, working with her in this way, putting the national interest, as they saw it, above his marriage. And he hurled abuse at his father and mother over this for the rest of their lives, and it was very bitter, something that they couldn't ever really resolve. But anyway, so Pamela found herself alone, wanted somehow not to have already seen the peak of her life, that she was 25, and was that it? Was how she thought. Now, in those days, women couldn't get interesting jobs on the whole, particularly women like her with no qualifications. The only way that she could have an interesting, fulfilling life, it seemed to her, and I think this is probably right, was by attaching herself to a man with an interesting, fulfilling, powerful life. And so she went through many men in Europe, including Alain Khan, Gianni Agnelli, who was the heir to the Fiat Empire, Elie de Rothschild, Stavros Niarchos, the Greek shipping tycoon, and many, many others, Elie de Rothschild as well, but never found what she needed, which was another project. I mean, that happened for a while with Gianni Agnelli, who had obviously, being Italian, fought on the wrong side in the war. The Allies were thinking of taking Fiat away from him altogether. He needed to rehabilitate himself and Fiat very quickly if that wasn't to happen. They met. They were both very sexy young people, but they could both see that there was an ulterior motive in getting together too, which was that she could perhaps help him rehabilitate himself. And she indeed did introduce him to Churchill over dinner in the south of France. Initially, Churchill was extremely reluctant. Pamela persuaded him because he considered Agnelli a former enemy, but also many, many important key Americans, including JFK, people in the CIA who she knew through Jock Whitney, one of her lovers during the war. And she was instrumental in really helping Agnelli become a world leader. Although he was a businessman, he operated on the world stage in a way that attracted the admiration of people like Henry Kissinger. So he was a great project, but after 4 years, that relationship failed. He was an Italian man in the 1950s and thought he could have endless affairs, and she didn't want that. And so that relationship collapsed. But finally, she met Leland Haywood, an American Broadway producer who brought the world as the Sound of Music. But when she met him, his career was failing somewhat. He, by the way, had met her once before. She didn't remember. He did. How could he not remember? It had been on a yacht, and she was with Agnelli at the time, and Agnelli had given her these huge, huge diamonds, so big and heavy that when she had them, wore them as earrings and turned her head, they would sock her neck and leave a black mark. And on that yacht, when they were both there, she had come up on deck wearing absolutely nothing except those diamonds. And Leland Haywood had never forgotten. They met. He was married to his wife Slim at the time, but she was running around Europe with Ernest Hemingway. So anyway, they eventually got a divorce, and he marries Pamela. And this is finally her ticket to America. This is in 1960, so she's waited 15 years to come to America, which she'd always wanted to do at the end of the war. But that marriage was not what she hoped it would be.
She eventually became a power in Democratic politics, right? The Democratic Party. How did that happen? What was her goal? She wanted to get back to power, did she?
Yes, she did. Power was what interested her. She loved money. She loved things that money could buy. But the thing that money could buy that was most interesting to her was a political salon or a route into politics. When Leland Hayward died, she nursed him through his illnesses. By the way, he became an alcoholic. It was all very, very tragic. But when he died in 1971, she was left really with very little money. She went to a party in Georgetown at Kay Graham's house, Kay Graham being the infamous, legendary publisher of the Washington Post, and Avril Harriman was also there, and he'd just lost his wife. He'd sort of shut Pamela out of his life for a long time. He'd wanted a political career. It hadn't really quite worked out, but now they met again, and it was almost as if they'd been together the whole time, and they got married shortly afterwards. And there was great affection there, undoubtedly. She worked really hard. He was 29 or 30 years older than her, worked really hard to sort of keep him young, keep him fit, keep him healthy, keep him happy. Everyone saw that and remarked on it. But he also gave her what she really wanted, which was, as her friend Kitty Carlisle once put it, love, lovely things, but perhaps most of all, the political arena. Now she was back. She was back into democratic politics. She was back in the country that had the power. I mean, power had shifted from Britain to America. America was now this superpower, incredibly important, exciting, forward-looking country. She took American citizenship and she wanted to be part of it. She wanted to use everything she had learned over the years to help her adopted homeland.
So she, at some point, saw some potential in young Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, right? I think she was early to that.
She was. So after the Reagan, Ronald Reagan landslide in 1980, when many Democrats thought that, you know, the party was almost finished and there was going to be a permanent realignment to the right and it was all hopeless, and she always thought, no, this is time to reinvent and rejuvenate the party, but we just need a winner. We need someone who will take us back to the White House. And went through various contenders, none of them worked out, but had spotted in 1980 this young governor of Arkansas who had just lost the election, wondered whether he had any future in politics. She knew he had a bit of a messy private life, but she saw beyond this or behind this that he had an exceptional political talent. So really from then on, she works with him. She fundraises for him. She introduces him to people he needs to know in Washington. She sort of projects him around, but also over sort of late night sessions in the House in Georgetown and elsewhere, she teaches him everything she learned from Churchill and everything else she'd learned all these years. And, you know, thinks that eventually, you know, over time, he would emerge into someone that really could win back the White House for the Democrats. And indeed, when he became president, when he won the election in 1992, in her papers, I found a personal letter from him saying that he would not have been ready to stand before America and to stand before the world as president without her help. And later on, he said he attributed a large, you know, his rise to the White House to her publicly, and said at her funeral that he was there, meaning at the White House, in quotes, no small measure because of her. And so she really did shape American politics in a really quite extraordinary way for someone with no formal qualifications, who was a Brit, also now an American, a woman at a time when women simply just did not have that kind of political clout. And she came in and she shook up the party and she brought new people in and new ideas and backed the people she saw as winners and made a huge difference.
Bill Clinton appointed her ambassador to France. And, you know, these ambassadorships, sometimes they're just, you know, political prizes. She became quite influential in that role.
Yeah, she did. I mean, extraordinary. So this was her first formal job, and she was 73 by this point. I mean, I'm sure she wished that she'd been a bit younger when it happened. But anyway, she was delighted when it did. So we're talking 1993 now. Clinton said it was the easiest decision he'd ever had to make, by the way, although he did take a while to announce it. There were quite a lot of brickbats thrown at her. People couldn't imagine why she was qualified for such a job. There were comments that she was an expert only in rich men's ceilings, that kind of thing. Not knowing, as Clinton did, just what she was able to do behind closed doors. And that became apparent in Paris, but only really, again, to those who worked by her side. Those included Bill Clinton, but also the President of France, Jacques Chirac. And her finest hour, perhaps, was during the Bosnia conflict. You might remember that was a genocide where tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Bosnians were being slaughtered by the Serbs. This was genocide once again on European soil. Various peace efforts had failed. The killing went on and on. She couldn't deal with it in the sense that, she knew what it was like to be in a country under bombardment. She became, according to witnesses such as Christiane Amanpour of CNN, who was that great war correspondent of the time, the moral conscience of the West, constantly trying to get leaders together to form an alliance so that they would do something. Eventually, she became this interlocutor between the French, who'd lost quite a few soldiers as peacekeepers, and Bosnia were keen, really keen, to get something that actually worked, and Clinton, who she lobbied constantly for him to take a leadership in intervention. So she became once again a sort of a back channel across the Atlantic, behind closed doors, not talked about at the time, gradually bringing those two leaders together, both sides completely trusting her. And when there was yet another outrage in Bosnia, in the end with the Brits as well, there was a Western alliance and a huge military operation that did cow the Serbs into submission. And not long after that, we had the Dayton Peace Accords. I mean, it wasn't known at the time, but Bill Clinton said to me, oh, yeah, I mean, she was a big part of our effort. She certainly helped shape what happened. And President Chirac, after she died, and President Chirac was quite an aloof person as well, not known to be emotional, but wrote a speech himself, which he gave standing over her coffin in Paris, describing her as a peerless diplomat who had helped make the world a safer place, and mentioned her in the same breath as Jefferson and Lincoln. So both men hugely grateful to what she had done in order to bring the world together to stop bloodshed. So it was no, obviously she did some fancy entertaining as well, but this was not just a political appointment to say thank you for all her work in getting Clinton elected. It was a real testing, challenging, grueling job. And she did it pretty well, it has to be said. And with very little understanding that that's what she had done.
Let's take another break. We'll come back after this brief break. We're talking with Sonia Purnell, author most recently of Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's astonishing life of power, seduction, and intrigue. More following this.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking today with Sonia Purnell, author of Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's astonishing life of power, seduction, and intrigue. Pamela Harriman was, at a certain point, tried to broker closer relations between the Soviet Union and the U.S., I think.
She is indeed. Yet again, this is not something that is really well known. Both she and Avril, when he was still alive, greatly feared another world conflict. I think if you've lived through one, your worst fears of another one, and particularly one that might be a nuclear conflict. And in 1983, the world indeed became very, very close on at least two occasions to world war by accident. This was something that was a real possibility and haunted both of them. When Andropov, Yuri Andropov, became leader of the Soviet Union in 1983, he was very little known in the West. We now know that he was one Putin's boss, for example, but he was also the mentor for Gorbachev, who was the great reforming Soviet leader right at the end of the Soviet Union. But at this point, nothing much is known about Yuri Andropov, but both Harrimans are determined to try and open some kind of channel of communication. They believe that talking was necessary, but always from a position of strength, talking with Moscow. And so really off their own bat, with a couple of officials from the State Department, a translator and a doctor, because Avril was very frail, very old at this point, couldn't really see or hear, but was still prepared to make this arduous trip to Moscow, even though it was not clear that Andropov would agree to see them. They arrived, and Andropov heard that Pamela was also there, and he'd heard these great legendary stories of her in the Second World War. She was incredibly famous in the Soviet Union and as the former daughter-in-law of Winston Churchill. So it was largely out of curiosity, wanting to meet this famous, glamorous woman, that he agreed. And so they met for a meeting about an hour and a half, where for the first time, the Soviet Union said, or he said, that the Soviet Union was interested in opening a channel of communication, that there were potential concessions that could be discussed, that the Soviets feared, perhaps even more than the West, the prospect of nuclear war. Well, this was an astonishing message. And by this point, because Avril was so frail, she was really very much taking the lead now, taking the baton on from him. He'd long been seen as a Russia expert, but now Pamela was kind of rising up in his place as he was fading. So she was able to convey this message to George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State at the time. And indeed, if nothing else, I mean, there were many other greater seismic forces at play, obviously, but if nothing else, it planted the seeds for conversations, for negotiations that led 3 or 4 years later to a key arms reduction treaty between America and the Soviet Union, signed by Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev. And it's interesting because Gorbachev and his wife, Reza, came to Moscow to sign the treaty. And it was as if they were rock gods. I mean, these were the first Soviet leaders who were friendly, it seemed, and personable, perhaps even approachable. Reza in particular, I mean, leaders' wives before had always looked sort of like miseries and had never come up into the public eye at all. But here was an attractive, smiling woman, obviously intelligent, with a mind of her own. Everyone wanted to meet her. Nancy Reagan invited her to the White House for tea, but she'd met Nancy once and they hadn't got on very well. But she was really interested in meeting Pamela properly. So she actually asked to come to Pamela's house in Georgetown. Incredible honor. Everyone was a bit miffed if they hadn't been included in this. And so, you know, this was a thanks, really, a public thanks to Pamela for all the work she'd done for many years, but including that trip to see Andropov to try and find a way to ease tensions between Moscow and Washington that were, you know, as at least as worrying as the ones that we have now. And Gorbachev made sure that she was invited to all the key events held in Washington those few days during his visit. And so this propelled her to a different level in DC. People saw her as someone who did have clout, who did have understanding of foreign policy. But still, as always in her life, there were people who thought she had got above her station, that she didn't know what she was doing. And so the criticism was continuous. It never stopped. But she was also winning over fans who began to really take her very seriously from that point onwards.
That perception of her, do you think that's changed or changing at this point?
I think it's changing. I'm certainly trying to change it because, you know, when you hear about what she did, so whether it's Bosnia or Russia or what she was doing during the Second World War, it's clear that she really did play a part in, again, as Clinton said in the eulogy at her funeral, in shaping world events. I mean, that is certainly clear. But I think, you know, there are always two questions about Pamela, and I would say these two questions are, but please don't answer them until you've read the book and made up your own mind. You know, was she just someone who was intent on acquiring vast wealth and stealing other people's husbands and, you know, becoming that great seductress? Or Was she a young woman born into a century ruled by men with this kind of curiosity and determination to be in the room when things were happening, and that ultimately she might be able to shape those things for the better to become some kind of power player? But the only way that was going to happen was by using whatever she had to make it happen. Or did one happen because of the other? I mean, those are the questions about her. I really, you know, urge people to read the book first before answering those questions, because there is an awful lot in it, both from her own papers, but other people's accounts as well, that have come out since she died, that are really jaw-dropping as to what she did behind closed doors. And I think it's fair to say that she has not had, you know, the credit or respect that she has been due. I only yesterday I had lunch with the British ambassador in Paris during her time as American ambassador. The residences are next door to each other, and he got to know her pretty well. And you know, he also was in awe of what she was able to achieve. He had heard all the rumors before he met her, and discovered that, you know, the reality was actually nothing like her reputation.
Is there a through line, I'm guessing there is, between Woman of No Importance and the biography of Clementine Churchill and this one?
Yes, I mean, in a sense, I see them as a trilogy of books. They happen to be about women, but really the common theme is figures who've been misunderstood, misrepresented, overlooked by history, but who did incredible things to make the world we live in a better place than it would have been otherwise, but who just simply have not been written up in the way that they deserve. And that actually, you know, I spent 5 years researching Pamela. The story ended up being quite different from what I thought it was at the beginning. The research was astonishing, hence that word in the title. But I think all three women are astonishing. And I've tried to really, I suppose, correct history a little bit, because before, I mean, if you take Clementine Churchill, she was often dismissed as a nuisance, as someone who had no good impact on her husband at all. But, you know, if you asked Churchill, he wrote that he could have done nothing in his life and or in his work without her. And the then American ambassador, Gil Wynant, said that if the future breeds historians of understanding, then Clementine Churchill will finally get her due. Well, I guess I'm trying to be here an historian of understanding, and I'm trying to give all three women, Clementine Churchill, Virginia Hall, and Pamela Harriman, their due.
Well, excellent book, well worth the read. Kingmaker, Pamela Harriman's Astonishing Life of Power, Seduction, and Intrigue. We've been talking with the author, Sonia Purnell. Sonia Purnell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. As we make our way through winter skies in the day and just after dusk, brilliant Mars just past opposition directly east above Red Butte Garden, Logan Canyon, or above the Moab Rim is still very close astronomically and outshines its neighbors, Pollux and Castor, making it a partial semicircle of Procyon that we keep an eye on every night. Fun to duck out in the chill and look for a few seconds at a time, or longer if you can. In the southwest, Venus still rages and pulls away from Saturn. Orion dominates high southeast after dinner time, with serene white Sirius sparkling below it. And just below Orion is Lepus the Rabbit. Its brightest star, Arneb, is only about 13 million years old. It's just a baby, but it's a lot bigger than the Sun. And scientists are talking about it again way out there. Corona Borealis, meaning Northern Crown in Latin. Corona Borealis, or Council of the Chiefs, as natives call it, is a semicircle of mostly dim stars that we've reported on last year, as some predicted a nova then. I first started seeing this formation in my sleeping bag in the backyard under the Milky Way, and listening to the transistor radio and distant local radio stations, with the radio waves traveling at the speed of light. Imagine, they still do. Well, astronomers are hoping that the star that isn't even visible right now in Corona Borealis, just in the void of the semicircle, goes off, and we'll be able to see the nova this year, hopefully bright enough to compete with Venus. This star is called T. Corona Borealis. T. Corona Borealis is a recurrent nova. That's a star that experiences eruptions on a regular basis. It was first recorded in 1217 and appears to happen at intervals of roughly 80 years. The last nova event was in 1946, and astronomers have found evidence that another is coming. T. Corona is actually a binary star system, meaning it is actually composed of two stars locked in orbit around a common center of gravity. One of these is a white dwarf star, the dense body left behind when a small to medium-sized star burns up all of its fuel. The other star in the system is a red giant, the stage between a main sequence star and a white dwarf in which a star expands by many times its size. White dwarfs are among the densest objects known to exist in the universe and exert tremendous gravitational force upon their neighbors. As the stars that make up T. Corona orbit each other, the white dwarf pulls so strongly that it actually strips gases away from the surface of the red giant. These stolen gases accumulate around the white dwarf and form a swirling ring known as an accretion disk. Over the course of decades, the white dwarf takes on more and more material from this red giant neighbor. This causes both the pressure and temperature on the surface of the white dwarf to increase until they eventually become too much and trigger a massive thermonuclear explosion. Accumulated gases are expelled from the white dwarf in a brilliant flash of light that we will be able to see from Earth with our own naked eyes. Once the explosion subsides, the process will begin again, ramping up to the next nova event. It's one sky, many cultures. The following from poet Tina Thomas, Taninja, Time.
The mysterious mentor, always changing, moving, contemplated but never touched, unseen, hiding in slot canyons and in a ray of early evening sunlight that touches a pink old-fashioned rose. It is time that has woven our souls together, thread by thread, memories and possibilities intertwined. Our connection to each other is an entity unto itself, an energy that transcends our physical selves and that travels on the delicate breeze, in lightning, and to the secret places where birds go.
So look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space and time. Skywatcher Leo T.